Hey guys, before we jump into today's show, I just want to remind you that time is running out for the Olympia Sync Summit Indiegogo campaign. We have a pre-sale going for tickets. If you want to buy a $51 ticket, that's a two-day all-access pass. For $300, you get a two-day all-access pass plus lodging for two nights and a bunch of stuff. Please check out the website, thesyncbook.com/OE2014. Even if you didn't want to get a ticket, you can, if you wanted, I've had a bunch of people say to me, hey, I want to help you film it. We want to see a video of what you guys do there. Well, on our shoestring budget, that's not going to happen unless we get some more donations to the Indiegogo campaign. So please go to thesyncbook.com/OE2014. Help us raise some funds so we can do this right. I'm just going to tell you real quick a list of who I know is going to be there so far. Of course, myself, Alan Abadesa Green, and Andras Jones are going to be hosting the event. We have Rodney Asher, the director of Room 237, Joe Alexander, Sync filmmaker, JJ Draw, who's been making a bunch of videos for Sync Book Press recently on our YouTube page. Please check that out. OG, who does the Keanu Code, he's been on Always Record. Andrew S. Griffin does the Red Dirt Report, he's been on 42 Minutes. Marty Leeds, he does Math Magic, I'm sure you'll know Marty Leeds. Will Morgan, co-host of 42 Minutes. Tim Murphy, also been on 42 Minutes, he's a Sync filmmaker. Scott Onstott from Secrets in Plain Sight, you guys know him. James Evan Pilato does Media Monarchy and New World Next Week and all that great stuff. David Plate, my brother from Always Record. Guillaume Simard, he's been on 42 Minutes. He's also been helping me out with a ton of stuff on the website the last few months. Great friend of Sync Book Press, does a lot of stuff behind the scenes, but a huge, huge thing. Both Guillaume and JJ Dra are flying in from France for this. So, come on, if they can do that, you can make it. We have Ezra Sanzerbell, does Tone Color Alchemy. We just put out a book of his called Astro Music. Michael Schacht does the blog Gossporn. He's been on both of our shows a bunch of times. Patrick Sivek was just recently on Always Record, is becoming a brilliant researcher here in the sync field. And also Fratter X, who now hosts a show on Sync Book Radio, The Middle Chamber, and you guys should be familiar with his work. I guess I should point out Marty Leeds. We have an announcement here. Marty Leeds is going to be doing a radio show for Sync Book Radio in the next few months. Keep an eye out for that. So everything's growing. We just need your participation and your support. So please jump in. We got about a week left as of my recording this, so it's not a lot of time. Please go to thesyncbook.com/OE2014. Thank you very much.
Way to the border in the shadow under the trees, down by a stream in a hollow. Turn your head, feel the
to read. Run to the treasury.
chess is wrong. And all the court is crowded round, and this is what she told the gathering. Go to the store by the dungeon, take all the red paint, take all the white. Make up a new born color, cover your neighbor, and we'll be alright. There'll be no game today, she cried across the board. Every day will be a holiday, and all the pieces
Yeah, so joining us is Richard Merrick. Richard, he's authored a couple books. One is called Interference. That's his earlier work. One of his more recent is called The Venus Blueprint. He's a former acoustical engineer, and I would say that his approach is multidisciplinary, to say the very least. So I'll hand it over to him, though, and let him introduce himself a little better, if you wouldn't mind, Richard.
Sure. Thanks, John. My background is, originally music and theory back in the 70s, but then that got me into interested in computers in the very early days, and visualizing music using geometry and so forth. And so unfortunately back then the computers weren't strong enough to be able to do the things that I was wanting them to do, so I ended up going into several different technology directions, including graphics and multimedia and some early search engines, and started up some companies, some tech companies, a game company, Seventh Level, and then a rich media company called Post Future, and ended up retiring, I guess, about 7 years ago, and started writing up and collecting a lot of the information, the research that I'd done over the years up to that point, and ended up authoring some books and discovering a lot of things in the process.
Now, can you kind of like introduce us to your basic theory, which I guess you could attach a lot of names to: Gaussian interference theory, polar interference theory, harmonic interference theory, but it's kind of a all-inclusive type of unified musical approach to life sciences and so on. So maybe if you could just kind of explain that a little bit before we get more into the details.
Sure. My original interest, insight over 30 years ago, 35 years ago now, was that had to do with music perception. I was very interested in music perception. And I started realizing that the patterns of music harmony, I was a theorist and studied that pretty heavily back then, and started discovering that these patterns had a unifying model that would be a standing wave model, and that the energy flow in a standing wave could be used to model and describe how we perceive music. So I became interested in visualizing music through this model and started developing that model further, especially over the past 10 years, and ended up discovering a number of things about how harmonics or the patterns that harmonics make when they interfere with one another in a standing wave, and that is the foundation of what has become really modern statistics based upon the Gaussian model, distribution model of Carl Gauss, and that this pattern, in particular the first derivative pattern, which is the temporal distribution of these harmonics as they vibrate within a, let's say, a guitar string, that is universal. That's a universal model that not only describes how music harmony traditionally has functioned, but also how the body and brain, the auditory system, and really all life, and to some degree or another, follows this same sort of harmonic distribution. And so how we perceive music then is a pattern matching process between the same interference pattern, the same Gaussian interference pattern that's found in a vibrating string can be found in the way the brain is organized, the physiology of the auditory system. So that's the foundation, anyway, of a whole series of visualization models that can be used to visualize music. And as I got further and further into that, I began to realize that, well, you know, I became interested in the history and how of music, and that got me into the history of religion, because much of religion is based on harmonic principles. If you go back, and in fact, the Rig Veda, you know, the oldest written scripture, is essentially a series of hymns, and the all of the principles that you go far enough back, you find that. That everything was based on some sort of, you know, musical harmony or harmonic processes.
Yeah, they all were. You got the Torah, the Tanakh, the whole deal is meant to be sung. The Bhagavad Gita is meant to be sung. The Yoga Sutras of Patanjali are meant to be played. I find what you're saying fascinating.
Yes, exactly. Well, but I didn't pursue it from that perspective. It was more of an interest in describing the connection, or what is the unifying theory between, you know, the physics of music and the physiology of life. And that model is this standing wave model in this Gaussian interference pattern.
Excuse my lack of familiarity with your work. I've heard of your book a number of times, at least the Venus Blueprint. Could you tell us a little bit of why it's called that?
Okay. I didn't start out to develop what became the Venus Blueprint. I became interested, as I mentioned earlier, I became interested in pursuing the history of this harmonic theory that seemed to be at the base of, you know, religion and government and civilizations, really. As I went further and further back, trying to trace the roots, I became interested and started to realize that temples of one sort or another, starting from more or less the Middle Ages and going back, because we've lost a lot of that knowledge since then, that as you go further and further back, they were developed to have psychoacoustical effect. And in studying the acoustics of these different spaces, of different temples, I became aware of, just like I did with music theory, that there was sort of a unifying model that was underneath this. And it connected to the ancient goddess religions, you know, and you know, the the connection of those goddesses, these various, you know, lion goddesses, really, to the planet Venus. And interestingly enough, you know, in parallel with this, Venus has a resonance pattern with Earth. I think a lot of people have become more and more aware of this in recent years, but it's been mostly overlooked, and I don't know. I wouldn't say it was consciously suppressed. It just sort of fell out of the discussion of science, and therefore out of the discussion of and the dialogue of religion or astronomy. But there are various resonances, really a whole set of resonances of planets and moons in our solar system. And the one that seems to have the deepest lore and the deepest connection to religion is the resonance between Venus and Earth. That resonance pattern appears as a rose kind of pattern, a five-petal rose kind of pattern in the sky that is traced out by the planet Venus over an eight-year period.
How do they do that? I'm really interested.
Well, there's five retrogrades of Venus over a eight-year period. And so a retrograde means that it appears to reverse direction. And really what it's doing is, either Venus is going faster than the Earth is, and it basically rotates around the sun 13 times for every 8 times the Earth goes around the sun. And that 13 to 8 is very close to a golden ratio. It's 1.625, and the golden ratio is 1.618033, so on. And so it approximates a pentacle over an eight-year period. It has five conjunctions, which appear to be 5 points.
Wow. I'm sorry. I just have to say, I keep having that line from Close Encounters of the Third Kind pop in my mind, where they're on the mountain and they say, "Everything's ready from the dark side of the moon. Play the five tones to communicate with the extraterrestrials." I'm sorry. I just have to put that out there.
That occurred to me too when I started realizing the connection. But in music, you have pentatonic scales, which form a core, you know, for a major or minor scale and for other modes. And so there is a connection of the way music has been organized traditionally and our perception of it and the actual resonance pattern between Venus and Earth. And so this pattern, this rose pattern, it was called the rose. It was also associated with the name, you know, Rosabelle or Rosalind. So the Venus blueprint actually is this petal or this pentacle pattern that Venus creates. That's essentially what the Venus blueprint is. It's a little more than that because there's an egg geometry associated with it as well, which goes back to the cosmic egg and Brahmananda in the Rig Veda and this idea that of various religions where, you know, the universe is essentially an egg and that out of that heaven and earth were born and so forth. And so this egg and this pentacle is all about fertility. You know, Venus and the various goddesses that the Roman Venus came from were fertility goddesses. And this pattern that the planet Venus made in the sky was a very sacred pattern. And in fact, the golden ratio, which is the proportions within a pentagram, if you just draw a pentagram, every child sort of learns to do that early on, every intersection of that is a golden ratio. And so this, it's also known as the divine proportion, and it's found in various monuments and sacred spaces throughout history, at least approximated. And so there was this connection between the sky and the patterns in the sky, led primarily by Venus, since it was so obvious. It was the morning star and the evening star. It was the feminine aspect of of the sun, similar to the moon, but there's kind of this wife, you know, mistress connection between the Venus and the moon. And so, you know, there's this pattern, as I came to discover, appears to be used to design sacred spaces around the world, you know, ancient ones up through the Middle Ages.
I'll assume you're familiar with the work of Scott Onstott with Secrets in Plain Sight.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So he has plenty of examples where he demonstrates what you're speaking to, specifically relating to the pentagram, as I recall. It's worth mentioning.
Yes. Well, and the interesting thing about the pentagram, it is a fundamental pattern, both, you know, in the harmonic patterns in a standing wave, but in patterns of what's known as sacred geometry. And so by no means is there only sort of one pattern. It's really more of layers of patterns that all fit together. And the golden ratio, the divine proportion, is at the center of all these sacred geometries. And all these sacred geometries, such as the squaring of the circle, the Vitruvian man, the canon that Vitruvius produced, that Leonardo da Vinci made famous, that's a function of the golden ratio as well.
Isn't the basis for the geometry behind Rosicrucianism? I'm sorry, someone's got something ringing there.
Yeah, where were we?
I was having the Fama and the Confessio, if I'm pronouncing those right, the Rosicrucian manuscripts that emerged at one point represented a specific geometry to the site of Christian Rosencrantz. And it's very relatable to what you're talking about, especially with what you're saying with the rose, the five petals. One of the first things that comes to my mind is in the center of the cube unfolded as the Rosicrucian cross, I can see that rose being presented. Whether or not it's Venus, I guess, is still open to debate, but it seems like that's what it's pointing to from what you're saying.
In my opinion, it is Venus. And so here's the connection, the thing that ended up becoming the book, The Venus Blueprint. I went over to Scotland a number of years ago to I'd struck up a relationship with Stuart Mitchell, who is a composer over there, and with his father had done some investigations into Rosalind Chapel. I don't know if you're familiar with their work, but they had discovered these cubes. They're really rectangular cubes that were carved into the ceiling of Rosalind Chapel. And again, Rosalind being a reference to the rose, and that these cubes appeared to be cymatic patterns or vibratory patterns. And they ended up identifying the tones associated with these patterns and actually reproduced a piece of music from these carvings. And these are carvings from the 15th century. So I started communicating with him, and we, you know, exchanged a number of emails and talked on Skype and so forth. And I went over there to visit, and there's three main pillars that separate the Holy of Holies section from the nave or the rest of the chapel, and those three were known as in Masonry or in Freemasonry, are known as the Master Pillar, the Journeyman Pillar, and the Apprentice Pillar. And the more ancient names for those was the Earl, the Shekinah, and the Prince. Well, the Earl and Prince are symbolic of David and Solomon from the Bible. The Shekinah was a sacred spot in a Hebrew temple, and that was the original name for this central pillar that was associated with the presence of the sacred feminine, which to the Hebrews was named Asherah. Well, you may be familiar with the goddesses, the Ashtart goddesses, the various ones that have the word ash in them, I guess. And these are all Venusian goddesses. So here is a pillar in this 15th century chapel that was associated with Venus. And so there's no speculation there. It's Other researchers confirmed that, and there's other Venus connections there. But so we knew that going into it. But the thing I couldn't figure out is, where did that come from, and why would the builders, the Sinclairs, the St. Clairs family, and along with a man by the name of Sir Gilbert Hay, who actually was also related to the Sinclairs through a Merovingian bloodline, through connections to the Normans up there, that why would they be sort of focusing on this Venus connection? And there's other connections there too. But when I was there, I went down into what's called the sacristy, which is the underground part of the chapel that connects to an underground crypt where the Sinclair barons were buried. And and in that, I noticed there's little etchings on the wall that were pointed out to me, that Stuart pointed out. And I looked at different ones of these, there's sacred geometries, there's some astronomy type of drawings in there, but there was one that nobody really had been able to figure out. And it was an etching of something that looked like a cell tower, or maybe more like an oil derrick. Now, this is from the 15th century, so it's neither of those. But it was very strange in that it had sort of this little cup at the top of the oil derrick, semicircle that was up there, and a central line at the top that had what you might think of as a caduceus sort of at the top, but it wasn't really that clear. And I took pictures of it and came back home and did some more research. So I finally found something that looked very similar to it in a Genis manuscript, which was a tower representation of the ancient sacred mountain of the Rig Veda, which is named Mount Meru.
Oh, yeah, there we go.
Okay, so here was a symbol placed right across from the opening, which is now sealed, to the crypt of Mount Meru.
You know, Mount Meru was represented by the Sri Yantra most commonly. You'll even find older depictions where they made it three-dimensional to emphasize that it's a mountain. It's been pointed out in our community before by Kevin Halcott that it's actually, if you examine it closely, you can see that it's made up of 42 triangles, which is really interesting because the 42 reoccurs in all the various systems, 42 things you say to Ma'at at the time of death to weigh your heart against that of a feather in the Egyptian mysticism. It's a 42-letter name you're supposed to visualize at the time of death as a Kabbalist. It's, the 42 that's contained in the Tefillin cube, etc. It's interesting that you're supposed to visualize the Sri Yantra as you die if you're Indian, if you're, serious Indian. So I find that really interesting.
Yes. Okay. So you've actually touched on several things that are pretty critical, pretty important here. The Sri Yantra Meru is the kind of the full name, or Sri Yantra. It, like you said, it's the symbol for the sacred mountain. Well, interestingly enough, if you perfectly balance, because you can, there's different ways of balancing the Sri Yantra. If you balance it perfectly, and there's actually an application online where you can play with it. If you balance it perfectly, you will get an Egyptian triangle in there, which is the triangle that was used to design the Great Pyramid. Now, the interesting thing about the Great Pyramid is that the Egyptians called it Mera, as very similar to Meru. And the land of Egypt itself was referred to as Tomera, or the land of Mera, the pyramid, or the Mount Meru. Well,
I thought it was Kem. Is that in Egyptian? I thought that's what they called it. I'm not familiar with what you're speaking to. Maybe it's a different dialect or something.
Yeah, all I know is that if you go out there and look up, the most ancient, Egyptian name of the Great Pyramid, that you will find that it was called Mera.
Right. You said for the land of Egypt was a similar title?
Tomera. Yes. Mm-hmm. Basically, there's so much time in there that there's been variations of and other names and nicknames used for almost any land. You know, sure. for instance, Canaan to the Egyptians was called Amaru. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, that sounds familiar. Yeah.
Well, the god that protected the Taurus Mountains are believed to protect the Taurus Mountains, or the Silver Mountains is the other name for them, up in Anatolia, was the god Amaru. And it's this connection of the word Maru, which incorporates, you know, the mare, which means the sea. And in the Rig Veda, Mount Maru emerges from the depths of the ocean into the furthest space, and there's seven mountain rings and water in between it. And so there's this whole cosmology based on this sacred mountain. And the idea in the Rig Veda was, and really it's at the base of all these religions, is this ascension process, that you ascend the mountain when you die, and you go through these seven heavens, in the Tibetan Book of the Dead, you have these seven levels that you go through before reincarnating, and you have an opportunity to escape and to stay within in this sort of in some heavenly realm along the way. And if you sort of fail in ascending at any point, then you eventually reincarnate. That's at the core of the Tibetan beliefs, and that is at the core of the most ancient Vedic principles of, you know, this is how things work. And this transcendental Mount Meru was at the center of it. Well, anyway, so this Vedic connection of Roslyn made me, you know, go in and do a lot more research into the Rig Veda, which, you know, there's four Vedas, and the Rig Veda is far more ancient than the others. It was probably, from the latest things that we can tell, probably brought into the Indus Valley by invading or missionary Aryans from Anatolia, and most anciently, Armenia. So there's this Armenian connection. Well, there are so many connections here to be made. I want to make sure that we're touching on things, because I could go off into the weeds here talking.
Well, I love it. Once,
yeah, no, it's awesome. That's the format of the show. We just want you to kind of go on whatever tangent feels right. But before you get going, Alan joined us on the call, so I'll just give you guys a brief introduction. So Alan, Richard Alan.
Hi there.
Hi, Richard. Wonderful to have you with us. Sorry I'm late. I've actually lost power twice already this morning. I'm hoping that I don't get cut off again here.
Well, thanks for having me on. You know, there's so much to be spoken about here, and trying to focus this is one of the more difficult things about these I found in having these interviews is to make it comprehensible in such a short period of time.
Well, you're doing a fantastic job.
Well, thanks.
And our time situation, we go as long as we need to go or as short as we need to go. It doesn't matter. We're okay. Very relaxed. We should qualify oftentimes before jumping into things that is the nature of what we're doing here. We're having a dialogue. And so we don't have like set up questions and kind of like this kind of time frame. We don't have commercial breaks. We just kind of go with the flow, sea refuses no river kind of attitude. And so, yeah, it's great to have you on. Everything you've been saying so far, I'm in total resonance with. So yeah, I appreciate it.
Okay. Well, thank you. So as you gave me a little time there to think and regroup a little bit, and to go back to your original question about what is the Venus Blueprint, and I described it as a resonance pattern of Venus and Earth, you know, in the sky, that that I found in both in Roslyn Chapel and the dimensions and the organization, the actual architectural design of that chapel, it has an impossibly perfect connection to this resonance pattern in the sky, which was known back then. I mean, this was in the 15th century when it was built. But I believe, and I think there's good evidence that this star-like pattern that Venus traces over 8 years goes back millennia. That you find the 5-point star in Egyptian hieroglyphs. You find it as a symbol for the Sumerians, which, by the way, Sumer or the Sumerians, I mean, the word Sumeru means wonderful Meru. So the Sumerians themselves could, at least according to the latest archaeological evidence, were probably founded by the same invading people from Anatolia, the Aryans, which means noble, from Anatolia and more specifically Armenia, that went into the Indus Valley, probably took this Vedic cosmology and some early form of the Rig Veda into India, or at least lent their cosmology to that. And the same thing happened going down into Mesopotamia and founding Sumer. You find all these connections, same connections or cosmological connections from Anatolia to Egypt, and obviously later on in other, really in Babylonia and Assyria and the whole Canaanite, all the Canaanite religion, religious deities and so forth can all be traced back to this Anatolian and Armenian astrotheology. So the question is, so what I found then is that this resonance pattern of Venus actually helps create psychoacoustical structures that are temples or spaces, sacred spaces. And you find these psychoacoustics going back very ancient to, for instance, the temple in Newgrange in Ireland and to the Hypogeum in Malta. You find that tuning spaces to chant was a central part of religion. And interestingly enough, there was this pattern from Venus that could actually help create these psychoacoustical spaces. And I began to ask the question, well, why were they doing that? To make a temple that resonates in some way, is that all they're trying to do, is to make some chant to sound better? And what I found, the more I researched and dug into it, I found that there's this parallel tradition that goes back to cave days and chanting in caves of taking various kinds of entheogenic or psychoactive plants, putting them into some sort of liquid, whether it's milk or wine or some other mixture, and drinking it as a communion in order to induce visions. And so religious visions really have their origin in these teacher plants that shamans and priests became familiar with and used in order to induce these direct revelations.
Are you familiar with that sutra in the Yoga Sutras, where it gives the different means towards the different levels of samadhi, and it doesn't claim anything for like Kaivalya or like the highest levels of attainment, but for the sub-levels, it recommends basically entheogens. And in the more recent versions of it, you won't find that, but if you find any of the older translations, they kept it in. And it has all the other means, like song and different types of practice, but it's right. included and it's at the forefront, which I find fascinating.
Well, at the core of the Rig Veda is Soma,
right?
The elixir of the gods. And Soma was the god of the moon as well. And of course, people like Gordon Wasson and Carl Ruck, who ethnobotanists in one form or another, or mycologists, there's all these names that people are trying to dream up to study entheogenic traditions, that they believe that it was a mushroom, in particular Amanita muscaria, but there's other psilocybin mushrooms.
Yeah, that's debatable, but yes.
It is debatable. But see, I don't believe that it's as important to be able to, you know, come down and say, oh, it's this one substance. I think that everybody had, you know, all of the cultures had their own little blends and their own things that were based on the things that they had local. I mean, you know,
Richard, I'm sorry. Is it so? If I'm remembering your book correctly, didn't you say that Vatican Hill is named after Vatica? Is that correct? Which was a hallucinogenic wine?
I've never heard that one. Wow.
Oh yeah. This is at least well known by the people there. Even spokespersons for the Vatican will tell you this story. But I was introduced to that when I actually took a tour of the Vatican and had a private guide, and she had studied it and spent a lot of time there studying it. But then I went and looked it up myself and became more familiar with it. Yes, there was once a number of female oracles, probably brought there from India, but there's no, you know, absolute evidence of that. But they and there was a necropolis there, and they lived there, and they grew this this plant that had a bitter taste, had bitter berries of some sort, but they would blend these things together into something they called a Vatika wine, and their goddess was named Vatika. And these are this was pre-Roman in the Etruscan period. And there's a great history that lasted, you know, at least a couple of hundred years, you know, after, well, at least to 200 AD, of different temples. There was the Sybil, you know, and Attis worship on one hill outside of Rome. And there was another hill that specialized in Mithric. The Mithric mysteries, and there's all kinds of Mithraeums, or these little cave temples built that have been found all over Rome. And Mithraism was very popular before Christianity took hold. And so on Vatican Hill, there was this old tradition of the Etruscans, where they had their oracles there, and they would drink this thing and hallucinate and tell the future or whatever, answer questions. Vatican is named after this Vatica wine.
Huh. I have to present something here. We had a guest on at one point, and it's a show, out of all the shows we've done, and it's the one I'm least proud of. We had Jan Irving on. Are you familiar with his work?
I don't think so.
Well, he's very into what you're speaking to, with substances, especially with Rome and various places. And if you cross-reference a lot of his stuff, it's kind of frustrating, because you can see that he kind of pulls out his jump to conclusions board a little bit, so to speak. I use that term a lot on this show. We have a tendency with guests where if something doesn't align with our understanding, we don't hold it back. And he didn't take very kindly to that. With certain points, but I was very much in agreement with most of his points, and it was really unfortunate, because when the ones that I didn't, it got very defensive, and it really was, it wasn't the best show. And even like cross-referencing my own reactions afterwards, I found that a lot of the things that I said were not true as well. And so I encourage anyone, either reading your book or listening to this, if there's something that they're curious about, to go and look it up for themselves, and not just take our word for it, you know.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I mean, that seems like it should be a given, but for some reason, apparently, it's not always.
Yeah.
And another. Oh, Ellen, yeah, go ahead.
I'm just curious where all these things overlap. This obviously is something that can't be researched. This would take us into a more of the speculative realm, but I'm really curious because this is actually something that's been on my mind a lot, this sort of crossover between these entheogenic rituals, trying to get into these trance states, as well as these certain structures and what they align with. I listened to an interview a few months back, I want to say this was December 2013, on Red Ice. The guy's name was James Swagger, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
I don't know if you're familiar with his work.
Yeah, I've gotten an email from him, and I've looked into it a little bit. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I listened to an interview with him, and he was talking, I believe, about Newgrange and the idea that there was actually an alignment there with Sirius. And he went through this whole thing about how it seemed there was funerary rites that would be affiliated with this space, and that it's almost like we have the ideas that, okay, we have the the Great Pyramids and these star shafts, these shafts that point to specific stars. He was saying there was the same thing here, also pointing to Sirius. So you have this commonality, not only in the sort of design, but in a specific alignment, and that it was pointing to that. And what was really powerful for me was not only that he was sort of going this idea that you're sending your loved ones, their departed souls, perhaps through this shaft to Sirius, but I had not only a corollary between certain things that I've researched that other traditions have found, but specifically in my own psychedelic exploration, coming to this idea that Sirius was this sort of station for this cycle of samsara. This is the sort of waiting room, if you will. So I thought it was interesting that we would have not only the sending the souls to Sirius, but when he mentioned this idea that you would also have births taking place around here, to me it became clear that there was almost a recapture. So when you speak of these cycles of samsara, of, you know, being in this cycle, but also to me there was something, and again this is very speculative because a lot of the evidence is a sort of instinctual correlation I'm making based on my entheogenic experiences. So I guess in all this what I'm trying to really ask is, how much credence do you personally give to the revelations that these people might have received in these states?
So my beliefs and my writings, I try to keep a little bit of a objectivity in my writing because I try to approach it a little more scientifically, you know, in other words,
yeah.
Right, because otherwise people just nail you and discredit you. So I try to, there is, when I'm speculating, I'm trying to be pretty clear about that. But, you know, for me, I see everything in terms of sort of probabilities and, you know, how likely is that based on everything I know at that particular time. My personal belief from my own sorts of experiences, my own entheogenic experiences, as well, is that there's something going on there. There's a true mystery, and there are other levels of perception that that do include information. And you know, I don't think that we're all that good at figuring out sometimes what that information is. But think about that: these ancient civilizations, these ancient cultures, had, you know, thousands of years of priests and you know, their priestly shamans experimenting with these substances and you know, traveling through, at least from a perceptual point of view, traveling through these other realms and, you know, coming back and I guess agreeing with one another to some extent as to what they experienced and trying to codify that in things like the Tibetan Book of the Dead and other writings. And so there, you know, symbolisms and metaphors and things like that are sometimes the only way that they or even we could explain some of these things. And a lot of that gets codified in these ancient religious practices, and then you know, deconstructed and twisted towards political purposes over time.
Oh yeah,
becoming right. And so forth. But if you go back before all of that corruption, you get to some pretty pure insights. And so, you know, that all of these religions, all our governments, all our institutions, everything are based upon what I think are an astrotheological cosmology, which is ultimately rooted in Anatolia and Armenia. So this is between the Caspian and Black Seas, in the fertile, you know, above the fertile and in the Fertile Crescent, northern Turkey today, basically, in Armenia, that all of that really started there. And that the purpose of that, and you find it in what's called the Yajna Soma ceremonies, or the Vayapaya is the ultimate ceremony of the Yajna ceremonies, that were in the very early Vedic practices and became Zoroastrian practices. They're all the same and just variations of taking this teacher plant, this, whether it's a mushroom or it's you know, some other, you know, cassia or ergot or you know, henbane or, you know, belladonna or you name it, in some combination, and drinking it and having visions. And in the vision, you know, the goal was to go into this other world, this after what you would be in the afterlife. And in the minds of the people doing it, this is up in the sky. And so they're using the plants, the plant kingdom, as a way to get to the sun and Venus and the moon and these other sky gods and the constellations. So this communion, the purpose of communion originally was as a way to blast your spirit up into the sky and meet the gods. And the reason to do that is so that you could figure out where to go when you die so that you wouldn't be reincarnated, because nobody wanted to come back into a world full of strife. And they were trying to figure out, how do I not come back here, please, you know? And they would drink the communion and then meet the gods and the goddesses. And by enough experiences like that, they would figure out, you know, how things worked, write it down, and teach other people about it. So maybe they wouldn't have to come back here either.
Well,
and
sense,
that's what I believe the purpose of temples, communions, you know, the gods and goddesses were visions. They were visions seen while attempting to get into the sky.
Well, I'm curious because I've after reading Terence McKenna's Food of the Gods many years ago, yep, is when I was first really introduced to this idea that the soma, the ancient soma, is still up for debate as to what the soma was.
Yes.
And I've since sort of followed up on some of that research. But what always struck me as interesting is that in modern usage, we consider Latin is body, right? Soma is body. Mm-hmm. What I'm curious is the correlation, if all these things are to get you out of your body, this is etymological concept that I'm always trying to wrap my mind around is... Were they trying to say something more with that, or is it just something that got lost in translation, do you think?
Well, Latin isn't as old as Sanskrit.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, so in Sanskrit, soma was the original name for the moon, the god or the spirit of the moon. It became Chandra later, but soma was the original moon god. But soma was also, see, the moon was thought to be full of soma, which was also this elixir of the gods. And so the ceremony, the ascension ceremony, to ascend into the sky involved this, I'll describe the the sacrificer's ritual, which was they would have a pole stuck in the ground called a yupa pole. And at the top of the yupa pole was a double cross, an X basically, or a cross, okay, at right angles. These could be made out of wood, for instance. But they were also later made out of stone and some other things. But even these days, when you see a Soma or a Vayapaya ceremony, which is rare to see, but they still have them occasionally, they will then put up these poles, put a cross at the top, put a circle around that cross, and that's called the sun door. And they would then, the sacrificer would be a man, and he'd have his wife there, and he would get a ladder, and it would be a seven-step ladder, because Vedic stupa, holy space, is a seven steps. And he would then begin to ascend this ladder while holding his wife's hand, and say, verily I declare this, ladder to heaven, and he would, go step by step saying different things. He'd say, ascend we, and his wife would reply, ascend we, and they would do this three times. He would eventually get up to the top. He would put his hand on this little wheel or circle that's on the top of this cross, which was called a wheaten wheel, and it was made of wheat, but it would have a food on it, and he would touch this food, and he'd smear it on himself and saying various things, and he would... And what was described then is the sun door would open, and he would be able to see behind the sun. The spirit of the sun, he'd see heaven, basically, Svarga, Indra's heaven. And then he would have earned the right to consume the Soma himself. So now, I'm sure different traditions would do different things, but whether you'd take the Soma before you ascended, or the Soma would be at the top and that you would consume it, you'd rub it on your belly first and that sort of thing, but then you would ultimately eat the Soma. Well, opening up the sun door is essentially the inducement of visions. And, I don't know about you, but the sky becomes extremely interesting in certain states. And so opening up the sun door is basically a description of, in having these visions induced by this Soma during the high ritual of Vayapaya in Vedic tradition. And you can trace the Christian cross, the maypole or the Christmas tree or anything back to this very ancient idea of a yupa pole being believed to symbolize the axis of Mount Meru, and that you were ascending Mount Meru when you were climbing that ladder up the yupa pole. So the Christian cross is in effect descended from Vedic tradition and the Soma communion.
Hmm. Now, Richard, let me ask you one thing as well. How do you connect the green man to Jesus too? So if we're talking about connections between Christianity and entheogenics, you also found the green man in Rosalind, and that led you to an archetype for Jesus. So how do you connect those two? Because I've brought it up in a prior show, and I know David was interested in that connection.
Very so
if you would explain
so, yeah.
it.
Sure. Well, the green man, first of all, there's 113 green men carved in Rosalind Chapel, which actually, I won't go into it now, but it's actually connected to moon cycles during an 8-year Venus cycle with Earth. There's 113 moons. Okay, again, Soma connection there with anytime you hear about the moon, in the most ancient sense, it's a connection with Soma. Well, the green man is a vegetation god, is the anthropological term used. And every culture has some variation of vegetation gods. Mithras was a vegetation god, ultimately. Attis was from Phrygia, which Phrygia was part of Anatolia, okay? It was one of the one of the cultures that were in Anatolia. And Dionysus, Greek Dionysus, I mean, Hercules, you know, the strength of Hercules, where did that come from? Well, it was essentially an entheogen as well. Now, it might have, you know, had some ephedrine, you know, speed in mixed in with it, but, you know.
So are you saying Popeye didn't really eat just spinach?
Exactly. All of these symbols that we have today that just seem cartoonish. I mean, the Pegasus and Aladdin and his magic carpet. I mean, that comes from Paganum Harmala. Pegasus' name is from Paganum Harmala, which is a seed that is used to dye carpets, magic carpets. You know, if you get it on your skin when you're doing it, then it soaks in and you have visions while you're working on your carpet or sitting on it.
Isn't that from an insect? I thought that dye was actually came from an insect they traditionally dyed all those carpets, which is why if you get the older carpet, you'll actually get, I think it's if you get it wet or something, but over time you can see it wears out, but that's a sign of that you got a real well done carpet, a rug. That they use this insect dye. I can't remember the specifics around it.
Yeah, I'm sure they use lots of different things in to produce different dyes. I mean, we still do that today to create oil paints and so forth. But Paganum Harmala, which was also called Syrian rue, was a seed that was used in Persian carpet making, and it does get you high. And some people believe that the soma was Paganum Harmala but that would be the Persian version. Which was called Homa, not Soma. It was all inherited because the Aryans came down, you know, southeast through what is now Iran, which, by the way, Iran is a version of Aryan. It's a, you know, dialectical spelling of Aryan.
Right.
And so Zoroastrianism is, it has the same fire ceremonies because they would use fire to deliver the Soma to the gods. That's prior to the Vayupeya ceremony I mentioned earlier. There's a burning of the ingredients of soma to deliver it to the gods first, because that's how they get it. Is that's how you gain their favor, is to give them soma so they get visionary too and get powerful.
Are you familiar with a yagya ceremony? If you do a yagya, Indian ceremony, you make like what the Tibetans do with the sand, colored sand, to create a mandala in the center of a circle. And I've taken part in a number of them. You basically make a fire in the center. You pour a coconut on there. You do this whole deal. It's a long, drawn out process. But you tie a red string around your wrist, and you take these seeds. Each person in the circle has seeds, and you're supposed to have fasted, and it's this whole preparatory thing, and you do it at full moons and eclipses. And and when you throw the seeds into the fire, they're literally, you're supposed to be meditating on them relating to samskaras, or your latent tendencies that are the cause for rebirth. And you throw them into the fire with a prayer, and you keep repeating the prayer with a group of people. And I was just discussing this correspondence with my rabbi, which we found really interesting, is that, you know, rabbis tie these red strings around their wrists, same exact kind of thing. Though if you go back far enough for the Hebrews, I've talked about this on the show before, they would tie a string to a goat and tie one to their wrist, and they basically push the goat off of a cliff, they sacrifice the goat. And then over time, if your string turns white, or they would also tie it to the temple door, if it turns white, it has taken your sins away. It's where the term scapegoat comes from. And in my opinion, it's the basis for a certain aspect of Christianity, which would probably upset some people. But that correlation, that the fact that when you tie that string with a yagya, you're supposed to keep that string on after the ceremony until it breaks on its own. You're not supposed to cut it. And you wait for it to turn white. And the white is a symbol of that the ritual is come to fruition, because it doesn't come to fruition during the ceremony itself. It takes time for it to go and move into place or to integrate or whatever you want to call it. So I don't know. I found that a really fascinating correlation.
So let me correlate that to something that I think maybe connects all of these things in some way. So the fire, as I mentioned, the soma was put into the fire, the ingredients of soma, which would be to the Hindus was milk and ghee and perhaps the mushrooms or whatever the entheogen was, and they would burn it to deliver it to the gods. So this fire ceremony precedes the ascension or the soma, ascension and ingestion ceremony. Okay, so think about, burn it, give it to the gods, and then I'm going to do this ritual to where I can eat it too, and so now I can go commune with the gods. Now, take that back to Solomon's temple and the Hebrew practices that you're talking about. On Yom Kippur, the Hebrew priest would atone for the sins of the people, and just the high priest, not all the priests, but just in particular the high priest on Yom Kippur would do this. And he would take a string, the string that you're talking about, covered with goat's blood with him into the Holy of Holies of the temple. Now, in Jerusalem, the Solomon's temple was built over the rock, the foundation stone. Okay, and
that's the belief. Yes,
that's what's believed. Okay, so I mean, but here's the interesting thing: there's the history of that stone, since it's the highest point. It's
enormous. It's a huge stone. I'm just pointing out that that's a big freaking stone, and it's underneath. You can go down there. People go down there every day.
To the Well of Souls, right?
Exactly.
So, what that stone, that rock? I mean, it's a boulder. It's a boulder. I don't know how you define a boulder, but it's big. Like you said, it was at this believed to be, directly underneath the Holy of Holies of Solomon's Temple, and that rock has a long history, preceding. That period of time where, people would come in and because it's a high point and it's a rock, it was used to sacrifice and burn things. It was a fire altar in effect. Mm-hmm. Well, so the high priest would go in, there would be things burning, on the, offerings on the fire altar. So I would say in the Vedic, if you understand this, the Hebrew beliefs as being a derivative of older and older traditions going back to Anatolia and the Armenian, Vedic ceremonies, then the first thing to do is to burn on the altar, on the foundation stone here, whatever the soma, your soma equivalent is. Well, there's some evidence that cannabis or cannabosum or whatever it was called back in those days could have been burnt on that altar. Also, the holy wood of the Hebrews was acacia, and acacia is full of DMT. Every variety of acacia, the bark or the root or different varieties of acacia have varying amounts of DMT or dimethyltryptamine, which is the most powerful psychedelic known to exist.
I didn't realize acacia was psychoactive, because the Masons also use that as well.
Exactly.
Do you make? I'm sorry to interrupt. I just want to ask a question here while you're talking about the stone and all this sort of stuff. If this perhaps is obvious, but we have the story of Jacob's ladder, right? Yes. Where Jacob has this dream that he climbs this ladder to heaven, and what does he do? But he has this stone there, and he does this ceremony on it. That to me sounds almost
it's
what you described.
The Hebrews believe about that stone as well. There's a consensus view that that is the stone that he had his vision upon.
Exactly.
Right. So I'm saying you're what you described earlier about this pole and the guy climbing the seven rungs of the ladder in this circle, to me sounded like the same exact concept.
Exactly. I believe that it is a story, whether it was to what extent it's historical versus mythological or let's say lore. I believe the Jacob's Ladder story is a variation of this Vayipayas ceremony, this ascension ceremony, and that when this Jacob's pillow being the same foundation stone, the rock of Mount Sion, the sacred mountain, of Jerusalem anyway, was that was a story that was sort of summarizing this ascension ceremony. And that this stone is essentially an ascension stone. I mean, after all, in Islamic faith, the Prophet Muhammad ascended from this stone, from this rock. And so there is this ascension lore that is associated with this. And I believe that on this rock, they burned things that, when breathed, would help induce visions. But the interesting thing is, according to what the high priest would do on Yom Kippur, is he would then spend time getting prepared to meet God in front of this altar in the Holy of Holies, the burning altar. So he's delivering the soma to the gods, call it what you will. And then when he's ready, he goes down underneath the rock. As you mentioned, there's stairs on one corner of the rock. It sticks out a little bit above ground. And there's some stairs there, and you go underneath the stone, and it's a small chamber called the Well of Souls. And in it, it's sort of like a conch shell that you can kind of hear the ocean. Well, inside this little chamber, you can kind of hear something that sounds like the wailing of souls, in hell. And that's what they believed. But a lot of people don't know this, but that's where they kept the Ark of the Covenant, was down in the Well of Souls. And there were two things in the Ark of the Covenant. One was the Torah, the holy book, the holy scripture, and the other was manna. Well, there's good evidence, as has been pointed out by a number of researchers, that manna was mushrooms. And that the high priest would then eat the manna and read the Torah. But there was something else that he would do. So if he got a buzz up above, then he's really, adding to it inside this little Well of Souls. And, of course, it's a very resonant chamber as well. Well, so I'm sure that he's chanting and doing reading the scripture or singing it. And he will then reach into his hoshin, which is his breastplate that he wears when his the priest's garb at that time, and the hoshin is covered with 12 jewels in a square, arranged in a square, and they represent the 12 tribes of Israel. And remember, Jacob was told in his vision while sleeping and seeing this ladder to heaven, he's told by God, he has a vision of God, and God tells him that his name is now Israel. Well, we could go off in the etymology of Israel, but the point here is that he's got the 12 tribes represented on his breastplate, and he reaches behind that breastplate to bring out two crystal objects, or lenses of some sort that are fashioned that he can look through. And they're called the Urim and the Thummim. And the Urim and the Thummim are crystals, sort of like crystal balls, if you will, that you'd look into them to see the future or to see God or have visions. So imagine having breathed all this stuff upstairs, you know, in front of the fire altar, and now he's down the Well of Souls eating manna, and he brings out these crystals and looks through them in order to help induce and focus his vision. He does whatever he does, but when he comes back, he's got that goat, that string that you mentioned that has goat blood on it. And according to what I've read, the way it worked is if the string still has goat's blood on it when he comes back, that that God is happy with his people, but I mean is unhappy with his people. But if it's clean, then he's happy with his people. Well, of course, if that's really what the way the ritual worked, well, then the string was always bloody, and God was unhappy with his people, and the priest then told him what God had told him, and they were good for another year. They were, you know, sort of atoned for another year, and they would work towards, you know, being better people and pleasing God better. But at any rate, that's a story that I've read in a couple of different scholarly papers describing the ritual. And to me, that ritual is the Vedic ritual, the Vayapaya ascension ceremony, in just another form. You know, soma is burnt and delivered to the gods, and then they consume it themselves and commune with the, sky gods.
Awesome. Thank you.
You know, and I think it's still going on in certain circles. I think that, you know, to get a little conspiratorial, if we want to get into that a little bit, if we get into the upper echelons of some of these groups and the ceremonies that they're engaging with, I mean, you could look at Bohemian Grove and look at the cremation of care. But I mean, the guy's running that.
Which is just the first night, and who the fuck knows what goes on for the next 2 weeks.
Right, right. So, I mean, I think you could really, I think it's a fair speculation to say this is still going on within some of these groups. And while there's maybe not any direct evidence, there's all these links that strongly indicated, at least from my perspective. And Richard, I know you bring that up now and again in the book. It's not something you focus on too much, but it is something you speculate on.
Yes, well, I think the Pope may in fact do that when he goes down to visit, St. Peter or Jupiter in the necropolis, you know, in private moments. It wouldn't surprise me. I mean, maybe not all of them, but, you know, I wouldn't doubt that Benedict didn't do that. I mean, he seems like the kind that would, for sure, keep that tradition going. I've just got to believe, like you said, that there are still elements of those mystery schools. That's what the mystery schools were. They were, you know, take the teacher plant and trip and, have visions.
Right.
Yeah.
And what, I think what relationship those people actually, I'm sorry, but what relationship those people actually have with that ritual, and how far removed, and because I mean, there was so much purification rites that stood before those rituals, mm-hmm. especially talking about the Hebrew priests from the bit that I know, that was everything. That was their life. There is no other life beyond their own atonement. And so I mean, talk about people just performing. It's not just the ritual that's the point. It's everything that stands behind the ritual that they're working on, and it's the context of the entire collective that's yes. adding to it. And so it's hard to know, you know, how these people are actually relating to these things and what that exactly means if they're still imitating some version of what that was. Does that make sense?
If I may just sort of interject real quick, I mean, one of the questions that I've sort of raised in myself many times, and John had a good answer to this last time I mentioned this, but every time someone says the idea that, you know, within the Vatican they're having these psychedelic sessions or this idea of Bohemian Grove, I always say to myself, I mean, I would have such a hard time imagining these guys are having anything near the experiences I've had and still manage to be some of the most brutal human beings on the planet is always a really strange correspondence for me. But at the same time, I couldn't help but picture in my mind, and I apologize for this divergence here, but I just couldn't help but picture in my mind this idea of going up the ladder, the sacrifice, going into the Well of Souls. I'm picturing The Shining, and you have Jack Torrance climbing up the staircase, getting, when he gets knocked down by Wendy, right, he climbs the ladder, then he ends up, she drags him, puts him into the storeroom, this well of souls where he communicates with spirits, all because he's trying to sacrifice and please some sort of vengeful spirit. So it makes me wonder whether we want to put any credence to this other realm and the visions or not. You know, do we have, for really sloppy, lack of a better term, you know, good things that we can commune with and higher knowledge that we can get, but also very dark and vengeful spirits, or, you know, what would keep them being so brutal?
I just had the same thought, Alan, earlier, and I wasn't going to say anything. It was my own trip. But when you made the comment about Popeye, I initially visualized olive oil. Even before I visualized Popeye, I see Shelley Duvall, who ended up being Wendy, I remember that her and Annie Hall, she says, "Oh, I'm a Rosicrucian," and she's wearing this dress covered with roses, and so I automatically, like, equate her with Venus, and so I was like, "Oh, Venus," and then I had this little process, and then I can't not say it after you just said that, so.
you know, the thing about that's great. I mean, the interesting thing that we keep coming back to, because we can't help it, is finding in pop culture some of these same, you know, ancient ideas that have kind of surfaced in innocent ways. They become, you know, children's fables and children's cartoons and things. I mean, I don't know if you're familiar with the Grimm brothers, you know, the Brothers Grimm.
Sure.
They weren't just fairy tale makers. They were anthropologists. You know, they studied Germanic folklore, and one of the things that they believed was that white elves or light elves. Let's see. There's three types of elves, the light, you know, light and then dark. And then there was the black elves, which were dwarves in European folklore. And they associated with those with different types of psychedelic mushrooms, because you have, you know, elf rings or fairy rings of mushrooms that form around coniferous pines or near coniferous pines because of the mycelium network. And that, you know, the lore is you get caught in a fairy ring, and they take you into their elf kingdom. And if you go back in, you know, Norse, you know, Odin and the Nordic mythology and the religion, the land of Odin and his court were these underworlds that were where the elves lived. And so there's this sort of this connection, this Nordic mythology that's associated, at least the Brothers Grimm believed it was associated with these, you know, with these mushrooms and these and rites associated with them. And again, all of that is in proximity to the, you know, Caucasus and the Armenian and Anatolian area where mushrooms are plentiful. They're found in the highlands, and of course there's the Siberians who still have mushroom ceremonies. You know, the whole Santa Claus thing. You know, you may have seen things about that associated with the Siberian reindeer herders,
uh-huh.
where they would,
the reindeer urine in the snow, right? They take the reindeer urine because the reindeer could take the Amanita, and then they urinate them out, and that purifies it, supposedly, for the people. So they're literally, yeah.
Well, and they you know, there's even videos on YouTube of a woman called Tatiana, who's, I think, seventh generation shaman in the Evan tribe in Kamchatka, Siberia. Who still collects the mushrooms, and they dry them, and you know, and they are migratory still in Kamchatka. They still have their reindeer herds and so forth, and you know, this is an old tradition, it's very connected with the Nordic mythologies. You know, this is you know, further, much further east, of course, but all of that connects very much with the Soma traditions of Anatolia. So, you know, when you talk about the green men, going back to your green men comment, I don't really see, you know, this is just me talking, okay? I don't see any real significant difference between the Jesus, you know, Christ character and lore surrounding that, and the Santa Claus or, you know, St. Nicholas or Father Christmas or the All-Father of the Nordics. And the, you know, they're all elves, right? Remember, Santa Claus is an elf, and he's got all these elves up in the North Pole. Well, this Green Man tradition, or this vegetalismo, or, you know, a vegetation god connection, is really consistent. Both the fact that we actually sort of celebrate both characters on Christmas is really just two sides of the same coin, I believe.
Yeah, I mean, every time Santa comes up, I'm thinking Satan for the anagram reason, and I'm sure I'm just, you know, I mean, I don't know, and I think Saint Nick, and I'm like, Nick is a name for Satan, and it's like, I mean, I've said this a number of times, but it's just because it's so fucking weird, is that, you know, it's like, you know, Santa Claus sees everybody, but nobody sees Santa Claus, you know, and he's got this kind of, like, big brother kind of thing behind him. It's kind of scary. It's a scary thing to tell your children, but, you know, we do it.
But Richard, your point then of them being two sides of the same coin, I think then becomes all the more valid. If you sort of have a, whether you want to put a dark edge on Santa or not, the fact that they're both celebrated at this time, it's like it's a fully rounded archetype, that it has both aspects.
Yes. So there's so many other green men, meaning personalities for teacher plants or for communion elixirs, over through different cultures over time, going back to the earliest recorded, which would be Soma, for instance. And Soma was the sun. The moon was considered the sun of essentially the sun, S-O-N, the sun of the sun, S-U-N, and Venus. The moon was originally a male-type figure, and it became associated with female because Venus will accompany the moon in, you know, into the underworld in the evening, at night.
Hmm.
You know, they'll rotate off into off the horizon, and that's the underworld.
I'm sorry. You go ahead this time.
Yeah, just real quick. And Richard, just talking about, again, two sides of the same coin, light and dark. I might have been misunderstanding your argument, but how do you derive the identity of Lucifer from Venus? Because I found that rather interesting.
Well, the word Lucifer.